Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Across America, the fight against the coronavirus is not going well. While some states have managed to bend the curve, most are seeing new spikes in infection rates and deaths. Over the past week, Florida saw an average of almost 9,000 new cases a day. Arizona reported more than 3,000. Texas, one of the first states to reopen, reported more than 10,000 new cases of COVID-19, a new single-day record. 2 months ago, states like New Jersey and New York were at the epicenter. Now, states in the South and the West worry that hospitals could be overwhelmed. This hour on Point, as the pandemic rages on, many states push ahead to reopen. We're going to talk about all of that. With us from Houston, Texas, is Luis Carrasco. He's editorial writer and member of the Houston Chronicle's editorial board. He's been a reporter and editor for English and Spanish language publications in Texas, Tennessee, and Arizona, where he was a member of the Arizona Daily Star's editorial board in Tucson. Luis, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
And great to be back, Anthony. Thank you.
Sure. Can you just give us a quick update on the situation in Texas? We mentioned 10,000 new cases of COVID-19, a new single-day record. That was just yesterday, I believe. What's going on there?
Yeah, no, actually, yesterday we set three new records. Not only did we have the 10,400 new infections statewide, but 75 deaths, which was a new high, and more than 9,200 Texans are hospitalized now with COVID-19, which was also a record.
Yeah,
it's looking pretty bleak right now.
And what explains this? Is it the fact that Texas was among, if not the first state, to sort of move toward reopening, even as cases were increasing? Is that your best understanding of what's going on?
Yeah, no, that is it. It is the speed of the reopening, and more than, you know, the governor said the right things. He implemented a phased reopening, which was supposed to, you know, you reach a benchmark and then you open a little more, reach a benchmark, open a little bit more. But once things seemed to be going well, even he ignored his own guidelines and things just reopened, sending the wrong kind of message to people, which was, things are okay, everything's over, go back to bars, go back to gyms. And that was just a real big mistake.
So what is Governor Greg Abbott saying now?
The governor has finally, he has faced reality and done the right thing. He issued a statewide mask order last week, which is a huge deal. As you know, unfortunately, wearing a mask has become this politicized thing. And so for a long time, he resisted that. There was a big fight when Harris County, which is where Houston is, the county judge here ordered a mask order that led to, you know, a huge clash among state officials. And now the governor has said, you know, actually, that is the right thing to do. But you have some counties which are saying, you know, sheriffs that are saying they're not going to enforce this order. There is still this huge disagreement on something that should be, you know, just common practice for everybody.
And it sounds like there's some disagreement, some tension between Governor Greg Abbott and your lieutenant governor, Dan Patrick. And I want to play a cut of tape from Patrick, who joined the Ingram angle on Fox News last Wednesday and essentially dismissed Dr. Anthony Fauci's concerns over the recent spike in Texas coronavirus cases.
Fauci said today that he's concerned about states like Texas that skipped over certain things. He doesn't know what he's talking about. We haven't skipped over anything. The only thing I'm skipping over is listening to him. You know, you have a lot of doctors on your show from day one. Your doctors have been right almost every time, and he has been wrong every time on every issue. I don't need his advice anymore.
So that's Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick saying that Anthony Fauci has been wrong every time. A lot of people would probably debate that with him, would disagree with him on that. But Luis, what kind of tension is there between the lieutenant governor and the governor?
The lieutenant governor is an elected office. So, you know, he's not like the vice president and the president. So there is this tension between the governor and the lieutenant governor, because they kind of represent two factions inside the Republican Party. Governor Abbott is, I guess you could say he's more moderate, and Patrick is kind of pushing on his right flank. And I mean, the lieutenant governor is famous for also going on Fox News and saying he was willing to die for the economy and the reopening. And so now you have the governor, again, doing the right thing, taking these steps, and the lieutenant governor can still, try to score points with the hardcore party faithful at the governor's expense, because, Patrick doesn't have to make those decisions that the governor is forced to do. So right. he has ambitions to be governor. So, it's easy to see why they're having that problem.
So, Luis, I want to ask you about the mask mandate. Is it an actual mandate from the governor that mask wearing statewide is now required, or is it an advisory? How is it being phrased in Texas?
It's again, it's a mandate, but it's basically unenforceable in a way. It really comes down to local officials, how enforceable that becomes, mostly because the governor in the past, he took away the ability for local officials to do much about anything about enforcement. And so it continues to be more of a suggestion. I was out and about this weekend, socially distancing, and I was just looking at a convenience store. You had people coming in with masks, going in without masks, and nobody was telling them to put a mask on. It's still not what we need, I guess, is what I'm
right.
What
right.
I'm
it's,
to
it
say.
Sounds like it's still subject to a sort of a healthy debate around whether a mask should be worn, can be worn, is enforceable. Let me ask you about something else in Texas, and that is the GOP state convention. It's currently scheduled, if my information here is correct, for July 16th in Houston. Some 6,000 plus people are anticipated to attend. Is that still going forward, even given the current situation?
That is still going forward. Houston is a busy convention town, but right now the GOP gathering is the only convention or conference that is still on the schedule. The Party Executive Committee met last week, and they voted 40-20 to go ahead with the in-person convention. So about 6,000 people are expected in downtown Houston, right now represents about a quarter of all cases in Texas, the Houston region does. So it is not the smartest of idea to be doing this right now.
Meanwhile, I was reading in preparation for this hour that there are medical experts in Houston that are concerned about a real crisis brewing there. That is, hospitals, for example, being overwhelmed if things continue at the current pace.
Yes, no. I mean, right now there are plenty of beds. I mean, statewide, there are still almost 13,000 beds available, 1,100 ICU beds, and 5,000 or so ventilators. So we're in good shape right now. But as you said, medical professionals are saying we cannot keep up with this pace. If this continues, if the number of cases, the number of hospitalizations continues to rise, the fear is that we will become the next New York. Houston has the largest amount of bed space in the state. We're home to a medical center, which is, I believe, the largest in the world. And officials here are still very, very worried that this could become a catastrophe.
Louise, stand by because I want to introduce Dr. Celine Gounder. She's an HIV infectious disease specialist and internist, as well as an epidemiologist. She's a professor of medicine and infectious diseases at New York University's Grossman School of Medicine and a journalist and filmmaker. She currently hosts and produces Epidemic, a podcast about the coronavirus pandemic, along with co-host Ron Klain. Dr. Gounder, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, Anthony.
Could you just give me your quick reaction about what you're hearing, first of all, from Luis Carrasco and his excellent reporting from Texas? It sounds like a really alarming situation in many parts of the country. What are you hearing?
Well, I don't think it's that Houston may become the next New York City. I think Houston is the next New York City, unfortunately. I think big picture, what I would call the great American COVID pandemic, because it is very specifically an American phenomenon, is a story of squandered time and opportunity. We implemented the shelter-in-place orders, some of them half-heartedly, including in Texas. And at the same time, we really wasted the time when we had those in place. That was time when states should have been preparing to contend with increasing cases as the disease spread throughout the country. And then also, once they did see community transmission, to be doing things like massive testing and contact tracing and isolation. And they simply wasted the time, didn't prepare, and now we find ourselves in a very difficult situation.
It seems like it's exactly what is happening was predicted precisely by healthcare experts. When states were considering and debating opening up, public health officials said if you open up while cases are still rising, they're going to continue to rise. And that seems to be what's happening. Not a surprise, right?
Yeah, this is not surprising at all. And I think that's what's really frustrating to so many of us is that we've been saying this for months now, that this is how it's going to play out. It's very predictable. And we've been saying this until we're blue in the face and no one is listening.
Well, Dr. Gounder, we want to keep you for the rest of the hour. There's a lot more to discuss about other parts of the country, about how states are dealing with it and what states need to do that they're not doing. Luis Carrasco, editorial writer and member of the Houston Chronicle's editorial board. Luis, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
And Dr. Gounder, stick with us. We're going to be talking more about the current state of the pandemic in the United States. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the pandemic and how infection rates and deaths are spiking in a majority of states, even as many of them continue to reopen. With us from New York City is Dr. Celine Gounder. She's a practicing HIV infectious diseases specialist and internist, as well as an epidemiologist. She's also a clinical assistant professor of medicine and infectious diseases at New York University's Grossman School of Medicine. And Celine Gounder, you know, I think you mentioned some of the states and some of the countries that did this right. And I'm talking to you from Boston. And, a couple of months ago, Massachusetts was one of the states that was at the epicenter of this pandemic. We saw the governor, Charlie Baker, close things down, listen to doctors. and wait until the surge passed and the numbers came down. The state is now in the process of cautiously reopening, and the numbers have remained down. But it seems like we know how to do this. Italy figured out how to do it. Spain figured out how to do it, just to name a couple of countries. Why couldn't the U.S.?
I think this is something Dr. Fauci has really been trying to speak to, which is that it's not the economy or public health. The only way to reopen the economy is by addressing public health. And so that actually is what has happened in cities like Boston, like where you are in New York City, where I am, is there was an understanding of that. So we had very rigorous relative to the rest of the country, shelter in place orders. In the meantime, we massively scaled up our testing capacity. New York City alone has hired some 3,000 contact tracers. We have places to send people, for example, hotels for isolation so that they won't infect the rest of their family. That kind of planning is exactly what needed to be done during these lockdowns. And guess what? It worked. You know, we're seeing dramatically lower rates in those areas, and we're getting to reopen our economy while the rest of the country isn't.
Mm-hmm. But is it, given what's happening in the rest of the country, does that present a kind of red flag warning to states, I don't know, like Massachusetts, like New York? In other words, is it inevitable that as you reopen, these numbers are going to rise again?
Well, not necessarily. If you can suppress community transmission to the point where other measures, you know, what I would call this would be the new normal, where we wear masks, where we remain 6 feet apart, where you have the big testing, the contact tracing, the isolation, those things can actually contain it if you can suppress community transmission enough. But once you have these massive surges in cases, that's not an option anymore. You're really, your only option at that point is to go back to very blunt measures like the lockdown measures. Mm.
So are you getting the sense that in the rest of the country and where things are really appear to be running out of control are many states in the South and the West. We mentioned Texas. Arizona is another one. We're going to be hearing from Arizona in a moment. But what has to happen there? Do they have to just, you know, really double down and do what states like Massachusetts and New York and New Jersey and a number of other states, Connecticut, did a while back?
Well, I think they're facing, you know, one of two choices, basically allowing the virus to run through its entire population, and that's going to result in many deaths, and that seems to be what they are choosing to do, or to really roll back measures, roll back the lifting of measures, I should say, and return to a lockdown and then do it right this time. Make the preparations that they need to be making to enter into the new normal and then have another shot at it. But I don't know if there's the political will to do it right.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, that is the key question, isn't it? Because, you mentioned how many of these states wasted time and opportunity here. And in that period of sort of wasted time, it seems like there was time for this politicization of this whole issue to grow and take root, so that a Governor Abbott in Texas can finally get to the point and say, yeah, it makes sense to wear a mask, something that has been happening in a state like Massachusetts for literally months. But there's so much politicization around it that not everybody's doing it. And you've got sheriffs refusing to enforce it. So it seems like that this lost time has really, meant the loss of an opportunity to move forward in the most logical way possible.
Well, that lost time is not just lost time, it's lost lives.
Yes, of course.
So, I think that's been a tremendous tragedy.
Well, let's introduce Dr. Saskia Popescu. She joins us from Phoenix, Arizona. She's an infectious disease epidemiologist and infection preventionist affiliated with the University of Arizona. She's also an external expert for the European Center for Disease Control. Dr. Popescu, thank you for joining us. It's great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you're in Arizona. I'd love to get an update there. What's the situation there? Give us the sort of quick two or three headlines about the situation in Arizona.
It's quite serious, unfortunately. Yesterday we reported over 3,600 new cases, and we've got in the state 100 and 105,000, I should say. So what we're looking at is about 55 cases per 100,000 people per day. And if you compare that to the other states, that's about 34% worse than the second worst state, which is Florida. And looking at percent positivity, about one in four people who are being tested are positive. So that's a 25% positivity rate. And ultimately, this is really concerning for our hospitals. ICUs are about 90% full. And what we're seeing is that one in five hospital beds are actually held by COVID patients in Arizona. So we've got 160 ICU beds available in the state. It's a very dire, very concerning situation. And unfortunately, this was very predictable and very avoidable.
Well, we're hearing that. We heard that from Dr. Gounder. Let's hear from Arizona Governor Doug Ducey, who joined Vice President Mike Pence for a press briefing last Wednesday at Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport. Here's Governor Ducey.
Our message is clear in terms of where Arizona is today. You are safer at home. We want to slow the spread of this virus and protect the most vulnerable. We have taken the steps to temporarily close bars and gyms and water parks, tubing, and movie theaters.
So, Dr. Popescu, does that sound like Governor Ducey is doing the right things to dial back this reopening and get this situation under control to you?
Well, it's really disjointed at this point. You know, we've closed bars, but casinos are still open. And a lot of this wasn't pushed out until it was absolutely dire. So what's concerning is that he really didn't allow the municipalities to impose their own orders until June. So mayors couldn't implement infection control measures like masking until then. And even now, you know, he's encouraging people to stay home, but there's no stay-at-home order in place. And we've seen a lot of politicization of public health in Arizona, especially when it came to the Arizona State University modeling team that was providing COVID-19 models for the state and county health departments, and how they were very quickly disbanded just before Governor Ducey announced restaurants could reopen, which happened to be a day before President Trump visited. So I think some of the concerning pieces with Governor Ducey's messaging is that they tend to ebb and wane. And unfortunately, you know, when we reopened, he very much said that we're past the point of COVID, we're doing great. And that really gave the impression that COVID wasn't an issue in Arizona, despite the fact that we didn't meet any of the gating criteria for opening. We were still seeing consistently well over 500 cases a day, and it rapidly skyrocketed past that point. So my concern is, you know, this kind of normalization of laxities on infection control measures and his messaging that really doesn't necessarily convey the seriousness of this.
Mm. I gather one of the challenges, too, in a state like Arizona, which is in the Sun Belt, obviously, you have consistently 100 plus degree temperatures in the summer, that the idea to encourage people to get outside also works against mitigation efforts because it's just too hot outside. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, it was very interesting to me as guidance was being pushed out across the country about go outside, you know, try and exercise outside or eat outside, that's safest. That really wasn't an option for those of us in Arizona or in the Southwest, where it's 100 degrees sometimes in the middle of the night. So it concerns me that we're not really acknowledging how there are limitations to that, those recommendations. And in Arizona, really the options are stay inside or sit by a pool if you have one. And even then, you know, you really have to be mindful that this is the time of year when people are going to try and get out of their house to go to those movie theaters, to go to the malls and the restaurants and the bars, because that's where it's air conditioned. That's where they can see their friends. And you know, it's really important to acknowledge that so we can try to mitigate that. So it's good that bars are closed. It's good that movie theaters are closed. But we also have to really consider other areas where people are going to be congregating because they simply can't be outside right now. It's, you know, 115 degrees. So it's unreasonable to give people that guidance.
Dr. Celine Gounder, I want to bring you back into the conversation. To what extent is the problem that we're facing a sort of lack of a unified message from the federal government? I mean, for a long time, we've been talking about how this has been left to individual states. And so we've seen a sort of hodgepodge approach from state to state and without a sort of consistent message from Washington about here's what you need to do in terms of masks, in terms of locking down, in terms of closing schools, in terms of how, when and where to reopen.
Well, you know, on the one hand, I do think there is a role for tailoring public health recommendations, as Dr. Popescu was just alluding to, based on local conditions. So, for example, the fact that it's 115 degrees in Arizona right now makes certain recommendations unrealistic. But at the same time, you really do need, for something like this, national guidance, national leadership, because this is an infectious disease that does not respect state borders. You know, only the federal government has the capacity to do things like manage supply chains in a way that is sensible, where states are not competing against each other. Only the federal government has the kinds of resources that the CDC has to do the research and really delve into these things in the way that's necessary right now. So, you know, I think the complete absence of that leadership and the politicization of this has really led to lost lives.
And so do we need to get to a point where basically everybody is using the same game plan? In other words, as you said, states have a certain amount of autonomy, as they should. But it seems like that when we see these spikes, there should be a sort of consistent game plan from state to state around the need to shut down, stay home, wear face masks. Don't we need that kind of consistent game plan that we're just not seeing state to state? To you again, Dr. Gounder.
Yeah, I mean, I think the gating criteria are a great example of this, you know, which really came down to, had you suppressed community transmission enough? Were hospitals ready to deal with a surge if it happened? So in other words, did they have enough empty hospital beds, enough empty ICU beds if there was a surge? Did they have the testing capacity, the contact tracing capacity? And the vast majority of states never met those gating criteria and have decided to reopen anyway. And I think that really needed to be hammered home from the federal level on down. And without that sort of rigor, of course, we're seeing each state doing their own thing.
Mm. Dr. Popescu, do you agree with that? Might that have helped, for example, a state like Arizona?
I entirely agree with Dr. Gounder. I think part of the issue is not only really strong national leadership, but at that point, especially for Arizona, when we were looking to reopen, was, you know, President Trump was really encouraging state leaders to reopen. And I think that just encouraged, you know, a very rapid, unfortunate reopening. We were one of the last states to close and one of the first to reopen. And not only that, but you're seeing not just premature reopening, but so fast that it doesn't give states, you know, public health and healthcare time to respond to things. So instead of several weeks for every single phase, we did it in a matter of 1 week. And this basically means that there's no time to identify when things are starting to rise again, when hospitals are becoming overwhelmed, until it's too late. So I think this was definitely an indication that across the board, there was poor leadership at a national and at a state level, because there was just such a desire to reopen without really understanding what needed to happen for that to occur safely.
Well, I want to play some tape from President Trump. Here he is yesterday. He held a meeting at the White House to talk about reopening American schools as soon as possible.
We want to reopen the schools. Everybody wants it. The moms want it. The dads want it. The kids want it. It's time to do it. You know, our mortality rate is right now at a level that people don't talk about, but it's down tenfold. So you look at deaths are way down from this horrible China virus, and it's a disgrace that it happened. Shouldn't have happened, but it did.
So that's President Trump speaking yesterday. I want to sort of fact check a couple of things that he said in there. Let me come to you first, Dr. Gounder. He talked about the mortality rate being way down, as if to suggest maybe this isn't as bad as the numbers suggest. Can you kind of fact check that for us? What's he referring to? Is he right? Is he wrong?
Well, first of all, you know, many of your listeners may have heard the expression lagging indicator, which means you don't die instantaneously when you are exposed and infected with coronavirus. It takes time. It takes time for you to develop symptoms. It takes time before you seek health care, before you go to the hospital. And then even once people go to the hospital, usually it takes about a week before they decompensate and need to be in the ICU. And then it could be another couple of weeks before they die. And so it can take weeks. It could take over a month from the time somebody is exposed to the time they die. So that's not reflected in these statistics yet. I think the other thing is a lot of the infections you're seeing right now are among younger people, but that's not going to remain isolated among younger people. That they may be driving it right now, but that's going to ripple out through the community. And again, that rippling may take time, but that is going to result in deaths among older people who do have higher death rates.
Mm. And Dr. Popescu, what do you think about the president pushing for schools to reopen at the end of the summer? Are most states ready for that? Is that in any way, shape, or form safe?
Well, I think the surge of cases across so many states is an indicator that we're not ready, and that, you know, if we can't have the responsibility of reopening slowly and safely, then we really need to highly consider that maybe schools won't be ready to reopen. Schools especially are a very challenging environment to respond to something like this. There's no precedent for it. So how do we do it safely? You know, being mindful that kids do need to get back to school. You know, parents need that as well. But we have to do it in such a way where we're not rushing it. We're ensuring that these are pragmatic solutions that people can actually follow and be safe. So I get very nervous when I hear President Trump pushing for that without any kind of guidance for it, especially across so many states that are struggling with basic reopening.
This whole question of whether and when and how to reopen schools is such an important one, and it's on the minds of so many people, parents, everybody, teachers, students as well, of course. And it's something I want to talk a little bit more about after the break that's just coming up. So Dr. Celine Gounder, Dr. Saskia Popescu, please stand by. We're talking about the coronavirus pandemic and how many states are struggling to bend the curves on infection. We're asking what went wrong and what's the path forward. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about the possibility of another financial sector crash. Are you a business owner who is worried about defaulting on loans? And listeners, were you affected by the housing crash in 2008? How has it changed the way you think about and use big banks? Tell us your story, 617-353-0683. Call that number and leave a message. And we'll put you on the air tomorrow, a program about the possibility of another financial sector crash. 617-353-0683. This hour, we're talking about the infection rates, how COVID-19 infection rates continue to spike in a majority of cases around the country. Joining me from New York City is Dr. Celine Gounder. She's a practicing HIV infectious disease specialist and internist and epidemiologist. And from Phoenix, Arizona, Dr. Saskia Popescu, infectious disease epidemiologist and infection preventionist, focused on hospital biopreparedness and the role of infection prevention in health security efforts. And let me introduce Monica Alba. She's an NBC News political reporter covering the White House in the 2020 campaign. You can find her reporting on NBC.com and frequently hear her live on NBC News program. Monica, good to have you back on Point. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
I'd love to get sort of the latest word from the White House regarding the pandemic. Is there an acknowledgement, or to what extent is there an acknowledgement that things aren't going well in a majority of states?
Yeah, we really saw a huge shift just this week in the public messaging from the White House telling Americans really that the virus is going to be with us, not just for the next few months through November, likely really for the next year until we have more information about a vaccine, and that people, in their words, need to, quote, live with it. And this is really a departure from what we saw in the early months of the pandemic, when at first the White House tried to dismiss this. You had the president saying the cases would likely go away. You had others saying new mile markers were going to be put into place every few months, that by Memorial Day, the vice president said it would be largely behind us. You had Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, saying by July, the country will really be rocking, in his words. And now here we are in nearly mid-July, and you have these spikes in cases, but the White House is trying to project a sense and semblance of normalcy. And I think that's really why you saw them yesterday trying to push so hard this idea that you can reopen schools in the fall. And you have the president also now openly fighting with his own CDC, his own members of the Trump administration and the health experts that are trying to help Americans navigate this. He's now telling them he disagrees with their tough guidelines for opening schools. And that's setting up a really, really big battle as these elementary and middle schools are making difficult decisions about how to reopen safely in the coming weeks.
Hmm. And what about guidance on things like, something as basic as wearing a mask? I know President Trump has resisted doing that, but not long ago, there was Mike Pence at an event, and he was suddenly talking about the importance of wearing a mask. Has the messaging on that begun to shift as well?
Absolutely. It's another example of mixed messaging in the past, and now they are going more towards a unified approach recommending face masks after resisting that for so long. And you have the vice president, who is the head of the coronavirus task force, trying to set this example. He's been traveling to all these hotspots. He went to Texas, Arizona, and Florida, and he wore a mask while on the ground there meeting with the governors of those states. But the president himself has now said he would wear a mask in a smaller situation. But the only time we've ever seen him do that is behind the scenes, when he was actually caught in a photograph at a plant in Michigan. And he came out and actually told reporters, "I don't want to wear a mask in front of you. I don't want to give you the pleasure of seeing that image." So for so long, he has been the leader of saying, "I personally don't want to wear a mask," and saying it's up to every individual. But you look at what we're heading toward, for example, next month with the Republican National Convention in Jacksonville, Florida, after the president uprooted it from Charlotte, North Carolina. That city currently has a mandatory mask mandate for indoors and outdoors. So is the president going to be addressing thousands of his supporters inside of an arena in Jacksonville next month? Will they all be wearing masks? If those local guidelines continue, the answer is yes. But have we seen the president himself model that behavior? Not quite. And as he heads to Florida at the end of this week and does other travel in the next few weeks related to his campaign, many local officials have urged him. Even his own Republican allies have urged him to set that example. But we just haven't seen that yet.
Mm. Before I let you go, Monica, one more question. I want to ask you about the White House Coronavirus Task Force, which I understand is going to be sort of reconstituting and making a return, but probably minus the president holding forth for long periods of time. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Exactly. And today is a great example. Vice President Mike Pence and other members of the task force, including Dr. Deborah Birx, will be briefing, but at the Department of Education. So this is something we've seen over the last week. They've been doing these task force briefings anywhere but the White House. Mm-hmm. And that's, we're told, from several White House officials, because the president himself decided he didn't want to be stepping on that messaging anymore. Sometimes those briefings back in March and April were going into 2 hours. They were veering totally off topic. And so aides and allies urged the president to remove himself from that situation and really let the health experts lead on that messaging. So that's now what you've seen from the Department of Health and Human Services, for example. You also had the vice president doing these briefings on the road when he was visiting these different hotspots. And I think you're going to continue to see that. And the president has really stepped back from being the daily messenger on coronavirus. Of course, he's asked about it in various interviews. He brings it up at almost all of his events. But when he does, and we just saw that this weekend, he often tells inaccurate claims, like 99% of all cases are totally harmless, which is something he said on Saturday that just is not true, Anthony.
Monica Alba, political reporter for NBC News, covering the White House and the 2020 campaign. Monica, thank you so much for your time today and bringing us up to date with news from Washington. Very grateful. I appreciate it.
You got it.
And still with us, Dr. Celine Gounder and Dr. Saskia Popescu. I wanted to come back, doctors, about this issue of schools reopening. We began to talk about it in the previous break. I'll start with you, Dr. Popescu. I mean, one thing that I'm curious about and I've sort of learned recently is schools have reopened in some foreign countries where the pandemic, where it didn't seem to affect the infection rates. Denmark opened schools in April, Finland in May. Neither saw a big spike in cases. Does that argue in favor of the president's plan that it might be okay to open schools cautiously?
I think one of the critical pieces is what are the cases you're seeing in the community of that school? Because it's very easy to say we can safely open a school in a community that is having very, very limited transmission. But if you were to reopen one in, say, Arizona or Texas right now, where the systems are very overwhelmed and stressed, that might pose a different problem. So much of this is really about looking at what's going on in the community and their ability to respond to cases, whether that's contact tracing or availability of testing that can be rapidly done. So my concern is, you know, we need to approach this in some ways from a national level, but also be very cognizant that each state and each county is in a vastly different situation that could impact the success and the safety of school openings.
Right. Dr. Gounder, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I do think that there may be differences between the younger age groups, so under 10-year-old versus older, based on some of the science that we're learning now in terms of risk of infection and risk of them, a child infecting an adult. Because that's really what this is largely about, is we want to be protecting the staff, the teachers, parents and grandparents back home, and we don't want children to be vectors of transmission. So there does seem to be some evolving science there where perhaps if community transmission is controlled enough and you can safely reopen schools, maybe you focus the reopening on the younger age group. That might be one way to mitigate the risk. I think one thing is really interesting. Texas came out with their guidance to schools yesterday, and I really question how that's going to be implemented. They're basically putting schools in the position of having to screen for symptoms and kind of do what public health departments should be doing, which is the contact tracing and isolation. I mean, basically doing that on a day-to-day basis in the schools. And I really don't understand how these really stressed school systems are going to take that on top of everything else they're supposed to be doing right now.
I wanted to use the rest of our time this hour to talk to you both a little bit about how our understanding around the coronavirus has evolved over the last couple of months. And let me come to you, Dr. Popescu, with the first question about this. What are we understanding now about the virus that we didn't know, say, 3 months ago?
Well, I think a hot topic as of late has been the notion of aerosol transmission. Mm-hmm. So, and this isn't necessarily new knowledge. You know, we've known that there can be aerosol transmission. And I think so much of this is really about how we communicate uncertainty. So to me, this is one of the biggest pieces. You know, beyond that, we're seeing more cases in younger people. But how are we communicating the uncertainty and the evolving nature of this pandemic? And the aerosol, you know, airborne droplet concept and topic. So I think that is a huge piece to this. And I realize that's not an entirely scientific thing, and you know, a new piece of knowledge, if you will. But really, it says, how are we communicating to the public that this is an evolving situation and that guidance might change? And these are the situations, the environments that pose a higher risk for, you know, super spreader events. And how do we communicate that effectively? Because as we do reopen schools and states ebb and wane through their reopening efforts, we have to be able to communicate that effectively so that people can be safe. And I think that's something that we've really got to me has been probably one of the biggest pieces as, you know, we've had that big debate with aerosol transmission. How are we truly communicating to the public new guidance and new information as it comes out? You know, as we're starting to see less talks about, you know, fomite transmission and, you know, but still emphasizing the importance of hand hygiene. So that to me has been probably the biggest learning moment for this pandemic.
And Dr. Gounder, with regard to airborne transmission, does that suggest that there's more and more evidence that people are much safer outdoors than indoors? Is that a safe conclusion?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And I think one thing that was really reassuring to me, you know, many of us were worried how things would evolve after the protests, whether the protests might contribute to increasing transmission in the community. And I think it was sort of a natural experiment, but one that played out pretty well because, for example, in New York, we had protests, but people were outdoors and they were, by and large, most of them were wearing masks. And so clearly the combination of wearing a mask and being outdoors really does protect against transmission. We haven't seen big spikes here, even, you know, more than a month later after the protests here in New York and other parts of the country. So, you know, I think that that should be good news because it means there are ways to move forward, at least on some activities, even, for example, a political campaign rally. Maybe you structure it as an outdoor march where people are wearing masks, where they're moving, they're outdoors. So I think there are ways to have a new normal based on what we're learning.
So how do we think about, though, for those of us who live in states that get cold come September, October, November, how should we be thinking about that, Dr. Gounder?
Well, you know, I think that's where some of the things that are being discussed now around ventilation are going to be really important. I mean, it could be as simple as just trying to keep windows and doors open. But for example, in New York, we're talking about HEPA filtration on our HVAC systems. There are other technologies like what's called ultraviolet germicidal irradiation that could be installed in at least some public spaces to reduce the risk of transmission in those places. But I do think masks and the 6 feet apart rule are really going to be front and center, especially as we move into the winter months up north.
Mm. And speaking of the winter months, Dr. Popescu, I'm curious to ask you both, actually, I'll start with you, Dr. Popescu, about the collision of the coronavirus with the winter flu season. How concerned are you about that? And what should people be thinking about in terms of staying as safe as possible?
I'm definitely concerned about that. I think people may not realize that when the coronavirus pandemic actually started, we were in a pretty severe flu season already in the United States. You know, hospitals were having a very high census in January and February. So I'm definitely concerned that as the winter months progress and we start to see an uptick in respiratory viruses, that we're also going to see spikes again in COVID-19 cases. So I'm hoping that people will take this seriously to make sure they get their flu shots and they engage in those flu, you know, respiratory virus prevention efforts, like hand hygiene, not touching your eyes, your mouth, things that we're already reiterating for COVID prevention, but really understanding that those, you know, having a bunch of people over for a game or some kind of event at your house where it's beyond your household does increase the risk. So how can we do these things safely in a time of flu and COVID-19? Because my concern is that we're going to have a big spike in respiratory viruses plus COVID, and hospitals are going to get really overwhelmed again, and that's going to impact our healthcare workers and our public health. So really getting your flu shot and being mindful of what you're doing right now and how that also can prevent respiratory viruses.
And Dr. Popescu, I want to stick with you with this next question. President Trump's decision to pull the U.S. out of the World Health Organization, what's your response to that? How does that affect our ability to work globally, I guess, to combat this pandemic?
I think it's absolutely the wrong decision. The irony of pulling out of the WHO during a pandemic, especially one that is hitting the United States so hard, is just, it's breathtaking. It is a very unfortunate decision. And, you know, I think the concern is that this will very much fracture us from the rest of the world and global health efforts. And also, it silos us in ways that I don't think people realize. The WHO does so much amazing work for chronic diseases, infectious diseases, and this is very isolating. And I worry that it's setting a very dangerous precedent and it will potentially lead to other countries doing the same thing. But ultimately, I think it sets a norm of not investing in global health and public health. And that's not a norm we want to do. It feels, you know, very much right now like we're shooting ourselves in the foot, like we're running during a marathon. And that's the wrong decision to be taking.
Well, Dr. Saskia Popescu and Dr. Celine Gounder, I want to thank you both very much for joining us today and helping us answer some of these important questions. I guess one of the big conclusions that I take away from this is it seems like we've been here for a while with this pandemic. On the other hand, it seems like we're just really in the opening phases of trying to deal with this pandemic. So on we go. Thank you for your expertise. Dr. Celine Gounder, practicing HIV infectious diseases specialist, internist, epidemiologist, and professor at New York University's Grossman School of Medicine. Dr. Gounder, thank you.
My pleasure.
And Dr. Popescu, infectious disease epidemiologist and infection preventionist. Dr. Popescu, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.